Hello and welcome to the Risk Map podcast for the first half of December 2015, produced by Control Risks, the international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker, Senior Managing Director for Political Risk, based in London.
And I'm Gala Riani, Director of Analysis for the Middle East and North Africa, also in London. Welcome to the podcast. As we lurch toward the end of another year, we face what appears to be an increasingly hostile geopolitical landscape. And the next 2 weeks provide no shortage of interesting material for discussion.
First, we're going to go to New York, where next month the United States takes over the rotating chairmanship of the United Nations Security Council. After that, we'll come back to London to discuss the evolving international response to Islamic State, or IS. Finally, we'll talk about next week's climate change talks in Paris.
To discuss the agenda facing the United States as it assumes the chair of the world's most powerful club, I spoke with Mike Moran, Managing Director for Political Risk in our New York office.
So, Mike, the U.S. will be chairing the U.N. Security Council in December. This is a rotating chairmanship, and it lasts for a month. So there's a lot obviously going on with regard to Syria and so on. But one thing that I'd like to hear your thoughts on is how is this playing out in terms of U.S.-Russia relations? Is this something that we're going to see specific focus on in December as a result of the U.S. chairing the Security Council?
Well, I think the agenda for the U.S. is to see if the tentative talks and tentative progress toward some kind of a consensual peace process in Syria can be salvaged. Obviously, there's Ukraine. There is some interesting energy markets, politics, and there's just a general feeling from the Washington standpoint that Putin is at war now with practically every one of his neighbors in some bizarre form, whether it's rhetorical or actual, and that's viewed from Washington's standpoint as somewhat dangerous.
Okay, Mike, so obviously in the U.S. we have its election season. How is all of this playing out within the debates? I mean, is this situation in Syria, the relationship with Russia, with Turkey, everything that you've mentioned, how is that playing out in the debates in the U.S. domestically?
Well, interestingly, you know, Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State, is the prohibitive front runner in the Democratic side. She's fairly hawkish on this. It has said repeatedly she would have instituted a no-fly zone years ago. So that has been her position. It's held her in fairly good stead. The Republican side, of course, is deeply divided between a kind of populist and almost isolationist wing, and then the kind of more traditional establishment Republicans, Marco Rubio, a senator from Florida, Jeb Bush, a former governor, whose brother, of course, is George W. Bush and father George H.W. Bush. But essentially, the established candidates would be more in favor of a no-fly approach to stepping up airstrikes, but also to, empowering the NSA to continue tapping phones both in the U.S. and around the world. That's something that rubs the populist wing raw. They're absolutely against the NSA's assumed powers, and that kind of becomes the crux of the argument. How much of this is an intelligence failure in Paris, and how might that kind of a failure be replicated in the United States in the future?
With the UN Security Council focused firmly on Syria and IS, I turn to Jonathan Wood, our Director for Global Issues, for additional insight on the trajectory of that conflict and the future of the international response in the wake of the Paris attacks.
Okay, Jonathan, let's start with talking about the status of the coalition. What is it looking like right now?
Well, at the moment, you still have two coalitions operating in effect. You have what we call the U.S. coalition to counter the Islamic State, which is comprised of the U.S., some of its major NATO allies, as well as regional partners such as Saudi Arabia and Jordan. You also then, on the other side of the equation, have a Russia, Syrian, and Iranian coalition, which is primarily oriented towards sustaining and upholding the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. What we've seen most recently, and especially after two high-profile attacks, one, the bombing of a Russian aircraft in Egypt, and two, attacks in Paris, are attempts to bring these coalitions closer together and unite their mission to degrade and ultimately destroy the Islamic State. But the Syrian battle space is enormously complicated, and recent events, not least the shootdown of a Russian aircraft along the Turkish border, have made this process more difficult.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about that. How does the shooting down of the Russian aircraft precisely affect the situation and the bringing together of these two coalitions?
Well, this shootdown in a part of the border region which has already been very tense between Russia and Turkey for more than a month now has really exposed the lingering, durable, and some would say fundamental differences in approaches to the Syrian conflict between Russia and between the U.S.-led coalition. Russia has responded to the shooting by highlighting what it alleges is Turkish support for ISIS through purchasing oil or allowing foreign fighters to transit its border and so on. Turkey, for its part, has reiterated its commitment to degrading and ultimately destroying ISIS and of course is a key partner by allowing the U.S. to use some of its air bases. It's made the political process much more difficult because both Russia and Turkey are two key parts of the equation to any political solution in Syria, and the recent talks in Vienna that seemed potentially optimistic about bringing such a political transition about have probably been set back considerably by what is a worsening and probably durably long-term negative relationship between those two countries.
So in light of all this, how effective will either coalition really be in achieving their stated aims?
Well, Russia's support for the Syrian government has very demonstrably brought it back from the brink. It was on the verge of military collapse, if not necessarily political collapse, before Russia intervened, and is now a player both domestically and diplomatically in terms of its participation in negotiations. The campaign against Islamic State, however, has made less progress. President Obama said the other day that the U.S.-led coalition has conducted more than 8,000 airstrikes against Islamic State, and yet the group still remains in control of substantial parts of Iraq and Syria, including its de facto capital, Raqqa, in Syria, and Iraq's second-largest city, Mosul. Perhaps more importantly, the escalating military campaign against Islamic State seems to have prompted increased intent to carry out attacks against those countries abroad. The bombing of the Russian aircraft, which we mentioned, the attacks in France, and the disclosure that Islamic State has external operation cells in Europe and perhaps elsewhere, and it's made threats most recently, both against the United States and against Southeast Asia and East Asia, suggests that it may well be shifting its strategy from one of focusing on consolidating its control in Iraq and Syria to one on executing retaliation against the countries participating in the coalition. And so in that sense, the military campaign, whatever its effect on the ground in Syria, may well be stimulating a more significant and more transnational global terrorism.
Thanks. Conflict isn't the only thing heating up around the world. It's now recognized that the world itself is growing warmer at a pace that could soon bring irreversible change to our environment. Next week, the world's leaders will assemble in Paris to discuss just that issue. Joining me in London is Molly McParland, our associate analyst for Global Issues. Molly, the leaders of the world will be gathering in Paris starting November 30th to discuss the topic of climate change. Can you tell us a little bit about the primary agenda, the main goal of this assembly?
Well, the UN Climate Change Summit is an annual event. This year is being held in Paris from November 30th to December 21st. There's going to be almost 150 world leaders there and representatives from business and all kinds of industries attending as well. The main goal this year is to achieve a legally binding global agreement to significantly reduce emissions by 2050 in order to limit global temperature increases to 2 degrees Celsius, above which we think there will be serious consequences for the planet.
Molly, what is the special limit of 2 degrees? Why has the UN conference chosen this particular number?
Above 2 degrees Celsius, the scientific community agrees that we will see significant and severe consequences from the global planet. They're likely to be irreversible. To give you an example of how serious the consequences can be for just a 2 degree difference in global temperatures, during the last ice age, the average temperatures were only 5 degrees lower than they are currently today.
Molly, which industries are most likely to be affected by whatever the outcome is of this particular round of talks, and what should business be looking for?
Well, I think that all businesses are going to be affected by the climate change negotiations, because while we are likely to see a binding agreement coming out of the Paris climate talks due to more consensus and will in the international community than ever before, we are unlikely to actually be able to maintain this 2-degree limit that the scientific community is warning. Current estimations, if all countries stick to their pledges that they have made ahead of the conference, is that we will see a 2.7 degree Celsius rise. This means that climate change insurance is becoming particularly important. In fact, Lloyd's of London has said it's something that all insurers should consider imperative in making their decisions. So it's something that all industries should be looking at as we move into a kind of adaptation to climate change rather than prevention of climate change. The coal industry is likely to be particularly affected by the talks. As one of the biggest sources of global emissions, it's likely to be a primary target for countries looking to cut their domestic emissions. China has already promised that they are going to peak their CO2 emissions by 2030, and they're going to do that by limiting their imports of coal, among other measures. And the US has made similar restrictions on the amount of coal that will be being produced. International environmental pressure to curb coal use is continuing to mount, and we're likely to see detrimental effects to the coal industry in the next few years.
Molly, just briefly in closing, the climate conferences, wherever they happen, are usually the target of quite a bit of environmental protest. Given the security environment around Paris in light of recent events there, what's your forecast about how this event will unfold?
Well, I think the security environment in Paris will be one of the strictest in the world during this conference. Previous to the Paris attacks, environmental activists had been promising the largest environmental direct action the continent of Europe had ever seen, including protests with hundreds of thousands of people, marches, games, and lots of events. These have all been banned in the wake of the terrorist attacks in November and are therefore unlikely to affect the conference, making the actual security environment safer for the people attending.
Molly McParland, thank you very much.
Before we sign off, we'd like to draw your attention to two more events on our radar in the coming couple of weeks.
On the 29th of November, Burkina Faso will hold presidential and legislative elections. The elections, the first since President Blaise Compaoré was overthrown in a popular uprising in October 2014, were initially scheduled for 11 October, but were delayed after a failed coup attempt by soldiers from the former presidential guard in September. Roch-Marc Christian Cabaret, a former Compaoré stalwart turned opponent, is the frontrunner. However, his main rival, Zéphirin Diabré, is likely to perform well, forcing a runoff in late December. Under this scenario, Control Risks thinks Cabaret is likely to be elected with a comfortable margin in the second round.
On December 6, parliamentary elections will be held in Venezuela, where President Victor Maduro continues to struggle with his country's economic decline.
That's it for this edition of the Risk Map podcast, produced by Control Risks, the international business risk consultancy. Our podcast is produced every other Friday and is released on iTunes, Podbean, or the Control Risks website, www.controlrisks.com. Also there, you'll find our latest thinking on the return of high-impact terrorism. For now, on behalf of my colleagues in 36 offices around the world, this is Charles Hecker in London, saying goodbye.
And also from London, I'm Gala Riani. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.